Walter thinks he's so pretentious and so cool with his film philosophy, but he still pronounces Robert Bresson as Bresson. Weed and spices make us yell incredibly loud. Plus, maybe more people should consider dating a staircase. They are actually pretty sexy. This is Fake Film Fans.
Hey everybody, welcome to Fake Film Fans. I'm Suede Best, the washed up child star.
I'm Walter, and I'm that untitled document you accidentally name with the first line of your essay.
And I'm Celine, and I'm your mother's evil ex-boyfriend reincarnated.
Still steamy, still sexy.
So we actually exist as human beings outside of this podcast, and that means we do talk to each other on the phone. And so a few nights ago, I was in bed probably at, I don't know what, like 7:30, Celine?
Mm-hmm. It was 8:30.
And I was, I don't know, probably looking at boobs on the internet. And I get a phone call from my dear friend, Celine. And you wanna sort of clue me in on where you were at that moment?
So I had some big plans to woke some smead and watch The Labyrinth while high. I was leaving the apartment to go to Buffalo Wild Wings, and I was thinking, oh my god, it's so crazy. Weed has no effect on me. And then I patted myself. And I realized that I left my keys in the apartment. I locked them inside the apartment. And my phone was at 3%. So I decided that the best course of action would be to just go to Buffalo Wild Wings and get some wings anyways. And I went on the scariest walk of my life. Everything was haunted on this walk. Everything was so scary on this walk. And then I used the last of my phone battery to call a locksmith. And I really felt like an animal in the zoo. All these couples were walking by staring at me, eating my wings on the porch of my apartment. And I got in. I was so high that I was really paranoid, though, that the locksmith was going to come in and attack me. So I barricaded all my furniture to the door. And in the process of glass, my entire bookshelf broke. And I stepped right into the glass. I was picking some glass out of my foot. But I felt like this would be a good time to call all my friends and say bye to them, because I was positive that the locksmith was going to slice me.
Yeah, that was the phone call I got, was Celine being like, I was sitting out and my next door neighbor and his mom came out and they let me borrow their charger and also gave me some napkins because I was covered in chicken grease.
Yeah.
Now I'm inside and I think he's coming to kill me. He's coming to get me. And I was like, Celine, the locksmiths, if they haven't gotten you already with their magic locksmith powers, they're not going to get you now. But that did not stop her, and so finally I told her, just barricade the door.
They can wait, you told me to do that?
No, I said if you're really anxious, just barricade the door.
As I was doing it, the only sober thought that made it through in my mind was, this is something someone who has cracked would do.
I get it though.
Have you ever been that stoned, Walter?
No, I mean, I don't smoke too much weed, because this is what I understand weed does. It transports you to movies. It, like, you enter the movie world, so serial killers, locksmiths, they're real. And then after you get sober, you come out of the movie, right? Is that what weed is?
I think I never fully came out of the movie. Because, you guys, they can open any door. They can open your door. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, but you know what else? You know who else can open any door? Someone who has access to YouTube and some bobby pins. Like, it's not hard to break into someone's house.
Or Kitty Pryde from X-Men.
She can turn into, she can become incorporeal and slide through walls.
Or someone with a very large leg.
That's true. They push it.
What would the leg do? What?
Celine, what kind of question is that? Obviously, they push their leg into the door until it opens.
I don't know. I never met anyone with a large leg, so.
You usually only meet people with two large legs or zero large legs.
It's never the one.
You actually can't open doors with two large legs because there's no levitation device for you to support yourself when you use your two large legs to push that door open.
Walter, there's no levitation device in your body.
I know, which is why you need one large leg. Yeah, because you need one large leg. Otherwise, you need the levitation device.
I realize I didn't turn off the fire off my stove, so just give
Walter, you lit a fire in your house?
This is an emergency. This is not getting cut out of the podcast. Walter just realized he left his stove on. And why did he leave it? Let's try and guess. Why do you think Walter left the stove on?
I think he wanted to roast a marshmallow. I think he wanted to make a little fire, roast a marshmallow.
If I know Walter, there's a good chance he used the stovetop as a way to light a cigarette.
Oh my God.
Did you leave the top of your stove on because you were trying to light a cigarette?
No, I left it on because I'm boiling beans, but I smelled my bean smell. You know, I had to put it back on simmer.
Did you boil all the water out the beans?
This is all going in the podcast, by the way.
Oh, all right. Celine, so how much weed do you smoke? Like, how come you had a moment where you thought, that's crazy, weed does not affect me?
I actually don't smoke that much, and I was telling myself, I'm never going to smoke very much at all ever again. But that's always how it happens, you know? And I think, also, I started Lexapro. I think it's probably bad to smoke a shit ton of weed on the new meds, maybe.
I did find that marijuana started affecting me more and more unpleasantly when I started taking anti-anxiety medication. Lexapro in particular. I have found these days I can get a little high by myself and it's okay, but the next day I feel like such trash. I feel so lethargic and like jittery at the same time, and it's almost not worth it. I get high maybe once a month, if that.
I don't know what Lexapro is.
So it makes life easier.
I was just gonna say, I've never gotten a straight answer from a therapist on what it is.
It's true. So for all we know, it could be drugs.
Do you think it's drugs?
It could be drugs. I think it is. I think it's a drug. Oh, I think it's a weed. I think it's an herb.
You think it's a herb? You know what? I had an herb epiphany. Herbs in your salads, spices in your smoothies.
So you're basically putting herbs in your milkshake.
No, you're putting spices in your milkshake. You're putting herbs in your salads.
What's a spice? Like, sugar is a spice, right?
I think a spice is more like cinnamon, cumin, paprika.
We've actually had this conversation a lot because in East Asians, we don't use spices. For all the white people who are like, oh my God, every other cuisine in the world tastes so much better because they use so much spices. We don't use spices at all. We just use salt, pepper, and soy sauce.
What about the dried chilies and the Szechuan peppercorns?
I don't view Szechuan peppercorns as a spice.
And what about like five spice and anise, like things that show up in...
Anise I don't view as a spice.
Walter, you're just not counting your spices as spices.
Yeah, you're just like, these aren't spices.
How are those not herbs?
I think it's about size.
Anise, you buy them as a whole.
But then you grind
it. Yeah, and then you can blend them up. And it becomes a spice.
Not if you're using it to cook.
So you would consider it just an ingredient.
Well, spices are an ingredient. Speaking of spices, I baked my neighbor an apology cake. And that was an idea I had while I was high. And then when I was sober, I was in the middle of baking a cake. And I was like, is this too much for some wet wipes and a charger?
Did you use spices? Because if so, Walter hates it.
I did not use spices. Are nuts a spice?
That's my point. Is rice a fucking spice? Is rice a spice?
Rice is a spice.
When you burn food, is the stove a spice in itself? Because you get the stove onto the fucking food. Does that make the stove a fucking spice? I think spices are one of the most stupid classifications in the entire world. It's so stupid. It makes no sense why you need to divide a spice from a fucking ingredient.
You know what? Well,
I said my piece.
I'm with you. I'm with you. It's just an ingredient. The only thing I think is worth mentioning is that some of these ingredients you don't want to eat by yourself, right? Like, you don't want to just chomp down on a star anise. You don't want to chomp down on like a big rock.
If you can't eat a spoonful of it, it's not a spice. Like, that's why sugar's not a spice, but salt is a spice.
What?
So like, rocks are a spice because you can't eat a tablespoon of them by themselves.
But you also can't eat one rock.
I could eat a rock right now.
Do it. Fucking do it, Swift.
You know what? If we get to 100 five-star reviews, I will eat a rock. I will do it. I will eat a rock. I will eat a pebble of myself. If we get Gargura on the podcast, my favorite YouTuber, I will eat a rock.
I was always curious because I don't injure my feet that much. Do you get scabs on the bottom of your feet?
The way they're looking right now is it's kind of these like broken blood vessels under the surface.
Yeah, isn't that weird that feet don't have scabs?
I think it's because the skin is so thick.
And I think you can get scabs under the thickness of the skin.
Yeah.
I always thought the feet skin was thinner when I touched it, but actually you guys make a lot of sense. Of course it would
be thicker. Well, maybe your golden feet that has never like touched the hard land before from your opulent tower in Hong Kong.
No, it just feels nicer, you know? The bottom of the feet feels softer.
Dude, not mine. Mine are like rock hard. Are you kidding me?
Oh. So it is my spoiled princess.
That's true. I mean, also, like, I have a little more of a rural lifestyle than you, so I can, like, walk around barefoot. I'm not about to go walk around Hong Kong without shoes on.
Oh, are you showing off your cows now, Suede?
You remember those memes that were like, you might be a redneck if...
They're not memes. They're bits from a stand-up comedian named Jeff Foxworthy, part of the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, along with Larry the Cable Guy, and that was his old bit. You might be a redneck, you know, Jeff Foxworthy. I think Jeff Dunham was part of the Blue Collar Comedy Tour for a little bit.
That is pretty interesting, because I hate that man.
You do hate that man. You think he's racist, and you are... You would be right. You would be correct. He is definitely a racist man. But I sure do think his puppets are funny. Not the racist one. That one's not good.
It seems like they're all racist. Why was I called Ahmed the Dead Terrorist in middle school? Why did that happen?
That's because Jeff Dunham sure was popular.
You might be a redneck if you like Jeff Dunham. Yeah.
Yeah. I hate to break it to people who like Jeff Dunham, but yeah, you might be a redneck. He like had a resurgence where he was trying to like do PC puppets, and I don't think did very well. He ruined puppets for a lot of people, because I think I would be a really great puppet stand-up.
He ruined people for a lot of puppets.
That's true. I think that next time we're all together, we're all going to get really high, and we're going to watch every piece of Jeff Dunham's stand-up played at the same time. So we'll have like 7 different screens going, all playing his stand-up at once.
God. Speaking of this, what the fuck is the point of the labyrinth? I don't get it.
Because there are these crazy puppets, Walter.
Yeah, no, it's back to the puppets. I mean, well, and it's also just weird. Have you seen the labyrinth, Walt?
No.
Wow. Walter,
you should watch the labyrinth for next movie.
I've tried to watch it for like so many fucking times, and it's so fucking...
It's good.
Like, it just doesn't make fucking sense to, like, obsess over.
Okay, now see, I will agree with you that I do not... I think it's a little bit like The Godfather. I think it's overrated. It is a fun movie. It is not the perfect film by any means. And it's not something I could watch over and over again. But I do think it is a good put on when people are over.
I think so.
Because everyone knows
it. You can talk through it.
It's got good music.
There are goofy parts.
Everyone can laugh at Sting's junk.
I just think that means people's brains are not intelligent enough to watch some of the more experimental films at the end of the day.
Well, it's crazy. I think the reason you don't like The Labyrinth is because you want to be a contrarian, because there is so much about that movie that you would like. There are characters that just are covered in trash.
And they smell like sludge.
No, like, there's a lot in that movie you would enjoy if you just, like, could stop being a pretentious dick.
All right, I'll stop being a pretentious dick and sit down and watch it.
Watched Evil Eye, a 2020 diaspora horror film about a woman who dates the reincarnation of her mother's ex-boyfriend. In the movie, there's this whole idea of, like, this girl, Pallavi's mom, is pressuring her to get married. She's setting her up with all of these Indian guys. She doesn't like any of them. And then she meets the perfect man. And throughout, there's this thread of, like, too good to be true, because it is, because he wants to kill
her. The mother's really interested in astrology, right? Vedic astrology? Ayurvedic astrology?
She's interested in Vedic astrology, and she also gives the daughter an evil eye bracelet, which is something that, like, Egyptian people have, Greek people have, lots of different groups of people have it.
Yeah, it's all over the Mediterranean and the Middle East, right?
It is all over. It's basically the idea of, like, the Hesed, it's like jinxing yourself. So, like, when people have a baby, they say, like, what an ugly baby. Because if you say, like, what a cute baby, some, like, horrible shit is gonna happen to the baby. The daughter wears this bracelet. Eventually, she takes it off because she's like, my mom's so controlling and she treats me as a failure. And I love my new boyfriend. And I'm going to wear the jewelry he gave me instead. So it's kind of interesting that there's this idea of, like, controlling mothers and controlling men are both people you might get jewelry from.
Have you been given jewelry from controlling people in your life?
Never a man. No, I mean, the only jewelry I've been given is, like, this belonged to your grandma, like, matrilineal jewels.
What about your super cool eyebrow piercing?
That was a gift from me to myself.
That was a you gift. That was a personal
self-care queen.
That was a personal.
That was a personal gift. My question for you guys is, do you believe in anything like the evil eye or evil eye adjacent, like jinxing, too good to be true, don't count your blessings?
So part of the ways in which I have trouble with reality and in my own brain is that I can get fixated on things that aren't real, like especially rituals. rituals and rules and stuff like that. So I make it a good point not to do these things unless I absolutely have to. So for instance, I jingle the knob on the store door after I lock it, and then I knock 3 times, and I do that twice, and I have to do that twice or I will be worried that the store's not been locked. But so I'm very careful about giving myself things like that. Like, I won't have my palm read, I won't do tarot. Not because I necessarily believe it's real, but because I can't have another thing to fixate on. I can't have another thing to, like, worry about. When I dropped out of college, and at my worst, I actually had to pick up all the rocks over a certain size that I saw, or something bad would happen. Walter, I don't know if you ever saw me do that, but it was... Do you remember me doing that?
I don't know.
We were all pretty drunk at the time.
When crazy people do crazy stuff, I just let them be.
Okay. Walter. Fair enough. No, but I mean, that's what it feels like. So I make it a point to keep all of the things that would be either classified as like cultural superstition or regular superstition outside of my frame of reference. I can't have that. It gives me issues.
I want to believe this stuff. I think it makes the world funner. I'm like the complete opposite of Suede, where Suede doesn't believe it, so he avoids it. I don't believe it and want to engage with it, but keep failing because it just looks so stupid.
Wow. I'm definitely more on the superstitious side. I don't sweep at night because everyone in my family is crazy in that kind of way.
Well, I want to enjoy it. That's what I mean, though. I think it's fun to be a little scared of city ghosts when I'm walking around the streets. But I'm not. Like, if someone is scared, I can get scared with them, and I get excited with that. So if I'm, like, with someone and they're, like, getting scared, I'm like, oh, my God. And now I'm getting that energy that they're scared, and I'm enjoying it. But it's hard for me to bring it out for myself.
I have little things that don't have a lot of weight that I allow myself. Like, for instance, I don't like to check and see how much money we've made in the store until the end of the day, because I feel like we'll stop making money if I check. And I try to stick to that one. And it's not, but that one doesn't have, like, a whole lot of danger to my everyday life. To whereas, like, Celine, you always kiss when we're at intersections, you kiss your fingers and then touch the top of the mirror. If I did that every time I was nervous in a car, I wouldn't be able to go anywhere. I would constantly be doing it. I literally wouldn't be able to drive. But I definitely can't do superstition. But you do, Celine. You do interact with it a good bit. I see you doing. Do you want to tell us about some of your other things?
Definitely not sweeping at night. Not giving someone scissors or sharp objects.
Do you have any of these that are born outside of cultural context? Right. So all of mine, with the exception of saying orangutan zupatunya when you pass a graveyard, I have zero cultural rituals. All of mine are ones I created in my bad brain. Do you have any that are outside of, like, your cultural context?
Yeah, I have. You know how in our front yard we have these, like, decorative lights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I never walk, like, straight through them. Like, I always weave through one of them. But not. I guess it's just a habit. I guess it's less of a superstition, more of a habit.
How? I'm very outside of these superstitious stuff. What's the best way you guys recommend someone who's not superstitious at all to navigate? So, for example, you said you don't like getting sharp objects as a gift. First of all, I don't give gifts because gifts are a superstition anyways.
What do you mean gifts are a superstition?
No, they are. It's a fucking custom. Comes from superstition. It's fucking bullshit. You don't need to give
it. It's not a superstition. It's like a cultural practice.
It's love. It's love.
Yeah. And you've given me so many things in my life.
I don't treat that as like a gift with weight in it. It's just like a fucking thing.
That's a lie. Because one of the favorite gifts I ever received was Walter gave me a giant bag of plastic dragons. Little plastic army man style dragons. And I still have them all.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was a casual gift.
Wait, it meant a lot to me. It meant a lot to
me. He's blushing.
You touching the fucking mirror means a lot to you too, right?
It means a lot, like, to Celine. It does.
Yeah. So, but my main question to this is, like, what happens if I give you scissors because I don't know?
Then I would be like, oh, let me give you a dollar so that it's not a gift.
That's true in Greece too. That's also a Greek thing. It's like all over the Mediterranean, the Middle Eastern. It's like you don't because it's like a severing, like you're going to cut yourself.
Ah, so a lot of superstitions have a type of like negation on the back. In case someone does something like this. Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, there are loopholes and there are metaphors.
Like if you spill salt, you have to throw it over your shoulder to get rid of the bad luck for that.
I have to apologize, Suede. It's just gonna sound like I'm calling you out, but I swear all these call-outs are related to what I'm about to say.
Okay.
Last week we talked about Duvida, the Hindi film by Manny Kaul. And even though the conversation was really good, I fucking sucked. I sucked so bad. I had so many regrets. I was trash. I was fucking trash.
You were trash.
I panicked too much. I didn't know how to defend what I liked about it. We have to revisit it a little.
Okay, I'm down.
I did want to say, Swade, you actually said a lot of fucking things that I loved about the movie. I just didn't register it in my brain when we were talking about
it. And Walter, it's because I am you, right? Like, we've spent enough time together to where, like, you and I are close to being the same person at this point.
I think there are, like, two things that sometimes you throw me off when we, like, talk about movies. And the first one is that sometimes you throw a label at me and ask me yes or no. And I fucking don't know how to respond to that.
Okay.
It's like, I'm not that, so I can't say yes. But I am that at the same time, in a way, so I can't say no.
What labels was I talking about? Can you give an example?
Last time, you said, hey, Walter, I think it's because I'm more into the heavy metal gross shit, and you are the pop princess of beauty.
I mean, you could also just say, well, I'm both, but I guess that's not, like, possible for you to say because of your brain.
Yeah,
your baby boy brain.
Okay, do you understand that saying, yes, I'm both is so much more, like, steps that your brain have to make when someone directs you with a yes and no question?
I mean, in the grand scheme... No, Walt, no, that's very easy to say. Whatever. I mean, no, that is not a complicated thing to say.
Right.
Ask me if I'm two things. Ask me if I'm two things right now.
No, you're prepared already, dude. That's why.
Okay.
It's got to be in the moment of a conversation where you get asked that and you get put on the spot and you panic.
I dare you during this podcast to try and catch me off guard, and I can be the most off guard I could be, and I'm still going to
do it. Are you gay or straight, Swade? Are you gay or straight?
I mean, that's actually not a fair question to ask me because I know how to answer this question easy. Yeah, which is that I'll fuck what I want.
What you want, not who you want?
Maybe it's a tree. Maybe it's a tree that's shaped like a butt.
Maybe it's a butt that's shaped like a tree, you know what I'm talking about.
Maybe it's a tree butt.
You're
maybe
looking
it's
for
a
some
sexy
of that.
Butt-shaped, tree-shaped butt.
Oh, I got one. Swade, do you like mangoes?
No, I don't like mangoes.
See? Because he's racist.
Cause I'm racist because I don't like mangoes. They're slimy and they're not cold. I would like a mango if it was cold.
Don't say that about us.
You are not a mango. You are, you know what fruit you are? You're a raisin. You're a crazy.
Oh my god. Crazy. You're a crazy little raisin.
So do mangoes and slime girls, are they like related?
Austin, who was on the podcast, we actually talked about this. I think the ideal slime girl would be a girl whose body is like composed of gushers, the outside of a gusher. But then her insides would be inside of a gusher. So the ideal slime girl is actually a gusher.
She can never fall.
She can never fall. She's perfect. She would have high regeneration powers. She could be like, hey, babe, I had a long day at the office filling out papers. Stanley and Dwight were there. It sure was terrible. Can I have some gushers? And she would like let you bite her finger off and you could have the sweet gusher
flavors.
Stanley
and Dwight?
Stanley and Dwight at the office. And Chandler.
Could I be any more Chandler?
Could I be any more Chandler? I'm the Chandler of this podcast.
You're the Chandler of this Bing.
The utter difference that we have sometimes when we talk about movies, now I'm giving you the label, right?
Okay.
I think you tend to understand aesthetics through patterns, while I don't always get there.
Okay, that's interesting.
So, right, like if you say, oh, this is interesting because it's a trash bin, a lot of times you like to bring references, like you start listing out different movies or different books with those trash bins that you enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm telling you guys, Swade will list out like 7 or 8 references and not elaborate on any of them, so I just cut out like 7 of them. So I leave 1 of them.
Which is terrible, because if you did a bibliography of this podcast every time I mentioned a book, you would like be the most literate person on planet Earth.
I don't think either or is like a problem. I think the labels are fine. I think the patterns are great. And I think the fact that I don't work in that flow like clashes. And I think that clash creates some type of like very interesting build on what I think Manny Kaul's films are usually about. An aesthetic on time. So I think Kaul is a director who treats time as an aesthetic rather than space or visuals. So let's talk about Manny Kaul. You said that Manny Kaul is a famous Indian director, but that's not entirely true. He always was sort of big when he was making films, but a lot of fucking Indian directors, art house Indian directors, hated his movies. They thought they were too pretentious. They thought they put away audiences and were inaccessible. Famously, Satyajit Ray hated Manny Cole. So, fuck you, Satyajit Ray! Fuck you!
Yeah, we hate this director and any movies he's made. I've seen them all.
Manny Cole's reputation sort of gets better as long as years go by. Actually, I'm not even going to lie. It's kind of after these old school art house movie directors in India start dying that his reputation increases. He is basically a student of Ritwak Ghatak, who is an Indian experimental director from the 60s. Both of them really loved Robert Bresson's understanding of shots. So I said that Cole wants to manipulate time in cinema. And that's something that you see in Bresson a lot, too. I was watching an interview of his to, like, back up what I was talking about. And he does exactly talk about this stuff. If you want to check out the video, there's an interview on YouTube at the 11th International Film Festival of Kerala. In that interview, he basically starts off with saying cinema to him is no longer a visual medium. Visual mediums are kind of dead because no longer are we just interested in looking at a tree being filmed, because I'm going to be like, fuck you. I can go out and look at a fucking tree. He also thinks that the myth of the control of cinema is a little broken. So in the filmmaking process, he believes that a lot of randomness happens, or stuff out of your control happens. And in order to really embrace that type of randomness, you have to understand cinema as a medium of time. And he took this from Bresson, basically. He talks a lot about shots being an existence of reaching rather than a completed action. It's like, because the shot never completely ever completes while you're watching that shot in the moment, you're sort of faced with the reality of how long, or the time of that shot. Not how long. That's a bad way to say it. Even the shot is really short. If the shot draws your attention to the length of that shot, that for him is a good shot.
I'm just trying to figure out what the fuck you just said. Are you saying that this idea is sort of that, like, because film is a medium that progresses in a direction, right? There is a beginning, there is a middle, and there is an end. The sort of artistry in a shot is not the shot as a static thing, like, look at this shot, but the fact that the shot is moving. And it has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Is it that, like, okay, like, if painting is 2D and sculpture is 3D, movies have the time dimension because there's a duration when you watch the shot, like, the duration is somewhat live or manipulated?
Yeah, if you believe in Einstein.
What do you mean? What do you mean you believe in Einstein? What do you mean? Like you don't believe in time?
That's not... Do you believe he was a person?
That's what I said, because he's relativity who believes in the fourth dimension as time. So, you guys are actually both fucking correct.
And Einstein was correct too, right? Einstein was correct?
Einstein was correct. I love my fucking science, baby. Physics,
dude,
baby.
Dude, we love science.
If you believe that kind of thing.
Physics, not science. All other scientific studies are flawed. Only physics.
Only physics.
I had a friend in Hong Kong who was super pretentious about physics and literally shit talk all other things about science. He would call biology not a real science and chemistry close to a real science, but physics was the master lord overlord. But I think all physicists have a bit of that in them.
Yeah.
Like how I am with film. But yeah, no, all you guys are all correct. And the thing is, time is like a two-folded thing. When you experience time, you experience it in the singular present moment that we experience it right now, and you experience it in that overall narrative that you sort of get after or before or whatever you want to call it. There's a narrative of time that you experience, and you experience the presence of time.
So wait, so are you talking about you can experience both moments, as in every moment I exist is a moment I've experienced, but also the understanding that there is I have created or have experienced a narrative that has past and present. Like right now, each time I exist, I'm existing in a moment, but I, as a human being, understand that there is a narrative of a past and a narrative of a present.
And it's kind of the combination of both things. And that it's not either or. It's that both of them together make time an aesthetic to experience.
We're back to either or again, right? It's not either or. It's both. Exactly. Okay, perfect.
That's what I meant by not shit-talking your pattern stuff and me not recognizing patterns. It's the same fucking conversation.
Yeah.
It's like you can recognize the narrative. You can recognize this sort of pattern of time and all this stuff, or you can recognize the fragments. And it kind of needs to be a combination of together to really, really, like, enjoy time aesthetically. So this is all in a little bit in his interview. I am elaborating a little more and adding probably a little more than I should, but I do believe it. So I said a bunch of fucking things last week that I just fucking failed at saying. And One of the things I said was discontinuous poetry, incredibly badly worded and a really shitty thing to say.
Yeah, I remember making fun of you for it.
But now that I've seen Mandy Cole's interview, I feel more fucking like, you know.
I wish you could. I wish you guys could see Walter. Walter is like bright red, like floating off the ground. There's like little energy beams. Like, like he feels the most powerful he's felt in a long time right now.
Because this is like stuff in cinema that's like fun to talk about, but it's like, sure, not everyone wants to talk about cinema like that. Some people just want to fucking put popcorn in the mouth and fucking shoot their jizz, you know?
Just shoot the jizz. Just shoot it all over while you watch the movie, right?
Oh, okay. In my opinion, it was always obvious when you look at other Mandy Cole films too. His first film, Usagi Roddy, the most plot he's ever done, has no plot either. But it has like no linear narrative structure. It just fucking scenes happen and you don't know what's in order. Not my favorite, but still, you can already tell he's like experimenting with that. The other example that I probably will start using a little more when we keep talking is Maddie Mann's, which is one of his like weirdo pseudo documentaries. It's a documentary about Indian pottery art. And that film also cuts back to people walking in museums all the time with, like, people making pottery art in the present. So you can tell he's, like, messing with time in that, too. But let's talk about Duvida. So my favorite example of the time stuff is it's that one scene where the wife is swinging on the swing set on the tree. And she's, like, swinging. And then swings slower. And it crosses all into one another. And then when it ends, it's suddenly, like, 4 years have passed in the film.
Yes. No, that was... It's surprisingly stuttery in the way time progresses. Like, instead of it progressing in a way that feels natural or perceivable, things just happen. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is the past, this is the future now. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Aesthetically, it's a very pleasing example to me. But last week we were talking about how there were so many weird shots of people just walking down staircases, walking down hallways. But this is something you didn't mention because I completely forgot too. The film uses a lot of still images that are just like a picture, and then immediately cuts into or cross dissolves into a girl walking down a staircase.
Yes, yeah.
Juxtaposition of those two things, I think, is like really important. A still image is like a really like, okay, you're watching time move because it's still. You're just waiting. Someone walking and doing nothing else except walking, it embraces the sense of like duration too. Because an action that's like so mundane that doesn't have any like symbolism or oomph to it really makes you face that duration of that walk. So it's not like either or, as I said. It's like in combination with both that I think DeVita really like excels at.
So what you're saying is it's watching these people walk is so boring that you have to be confronted with the length of their walking. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, you can, that's the thing. You can call it boring, but that also like, I think what you do when you say something like that, Suede, is that you're revealing that you don't enjoy confronting passing of time. You find confrontation of passing of time boring. That's what it sounds like you're saying here.
Or is it both?
Yeah, I think it might be both.
Like, what do you like just enjoying the passing of time? Because it is harder to do in this capitalist society. If we want to put it back to fucking reality.
I am pretty impatient, and I also, if I'm not stimulated, my mind goes to some pretty unpleasant places pretty quick. So it's very hard for me to just like sit and enjoy the passage of time. Really, the only way I can do that is if I'm smoking a cigarette.
Dude, next time I watch DeVita, just chain smoke cigarettes. You might actually be like, whoa, what the fuck? This movie's amazing.
Okay. I'll buy a pack of cigarettes, I'll sit down, I'll watch DeVita, and I'll not quit smoking the entire time. Just I'll continuously cane smoke. No, it's Celine. So you and I have spent a lot of time together, but we are usually conversing and interacting during these periods. Are you good at just like sitting and experiencing time move in a direction?
If I am in the right headspace, like if I'm broken up with my phone, for example, I can just ride that wave till the cows come home.
Dude, surfers, baby.
Surfers.
That's why people love surfers.
That is why people love surfers. They ride that wave. And some people pop that bubble.
You know, there are actually articles that have been written about how surfing is a transcendent experience because you're like riding that wave and you're like in the moment. There's like academic fucking articles.
Whoa. Academic articles?
Yeah, Celine and I are from Roanoke. We actually just learned to read. Like in college, that's when we learned to read. So I don't know.
Yeah, I still, that's shaky.
My biggest problem is the vowels. Why there are so many?
My biggest problem is the letters.
Someone who actually is listening to this that is illiterate and feels like we're calling you out. No, you probably experience reading more genuinely than we do because you experience it in a way that's like you're riding the fucking waves of reading. While we've gone through the narrative and we just conclude and we don't get to experience the time of it.
I will also say if you're struggling in school, don't worry. Walter was the worst student I'd ever seen. Walter like never did any work and came drunk to class all the time. And he managed to graduate. So you'll be okay. If you're struggling in college right now, just remember, you can't do worse than Walter.
I would also say if you're in first or second grade learning to read, you should not be listening to this podcast.
I disagree.
There is some adult content.
Celine, I wasn't talking about fucking two-year-olds. I'm talking about a 25-year-old that's illiterate.
Oh, my 12-year-old gang, what up? Smash that like button, subscribe, go eat a Dunkaroo. Dunkaroos.
You know your mom's credit card? Think about it.
Give us 5 stars. And a Vespa.
Give us the numbers of your mom's credit card.
Also, if you're an adult, you can do that.
That's true, too.
Yeah.
That's actually what I do.
Yeah. That's what Walter said. Walter just, I need to use my mommy's credit card.
Oh, my God.
No. My mommy.
That is savage.
Okay. I'm going to add one more bit into Manny Cole's stuff that he has never said. So if Manny Cole, you're from heaven and you hear this and you cringe, I apologize.
We'll get him on the podcast. We'll get him. He's dead. We'll dig up his body and put him on the podcast. Dig up his grave.
I think to really flirt with time as an aesthetic, and I think this is an ongoing process. Actually, Manny Cole, this is something Manny Cole actually said. He said that he thinks it's really difficult because we still think of storytelling as representation. So it's very hard for us to get out of that mindset. But I think if you really want to continue working with movies as a medium of time, one of the things that is also important in that aspect is time involves so much imagination.
I think what you're talking about, right, is that we can only perceive time in the moment, right? There's no ability to perceive the past or the present. We can only use our imagination to perceive those things, right? Like there's no way to grab onto an object that is the past. There's no ontology of the past, right? It's a thing that is transient and ceases
to
exist.
Well, that's true. Can't we also not perceive the present because the present becomes the past so immediately?
What you said, Celine, is like one of the big debates, right? Meditation is about trying to recognize the present. There's almost something in that even though it is a fleeting thing and keeps going away, you still are able to achieve it in milliseconds or seconds or whatever you want to call it. Celine is right. You can argue the present is a fleeting imagination, but then there is an argument where, no, but wait, there's positive effects of actually recognizing that passing of time in a very present way. It's probably a combination of both. That's our buzzword.
It's both.
So in Duvida, we can talk a little bit about it, but I think a better example is Maddie Mann's, that pottery film I was talking about. So in that movie, it shows the steps of pottery. Each singular step is a fragment or a present moment, and you're just fucking watching it. So you have to face yourself fucking watching these steps in that duration. And then you realize those steps are part of like a very big tradition of a community of pottery making. And that community is complicated in a way because there's individual artistry, but it also comes from a long tradition of pottery making that comes from the past. And suddenly, there's this huge linkage to the ancestral past from what you're watching on the screen. And that's what I think the imagination of time is unique with, because there's a weight to the imagination of time, future or past. That's like the thing. It's not just, oh, I can imagine time. That's interesting.
Well, because it's a real imagination, right? It's not just that it's not like when I'm just like sitting there and I'm like thinking about how sweet it would be to be like a dope samurai wizard, like a wizard who also has a sweet sword. Like that doesn't have a lot of weight. But when I'm like imagining like when my grandma and I'm like remembering like being a child and like playing with her elbow skin and her being like, man, you sure are a weird little kid, but I love you because you're my grandson. That's an imagination of something that has weight. It has realism. It has truth to me. Whether it's real or not, it has weight because it's not just me as a wizard.
I do think you imagining yourself as a wizard can have weight. I don't want to dismiss all the wizard imaginative people and say you guys don't have weight. You can have weight. That's why D&D campaigns come about.
That's true.
But at the same time, it's not just like, oh, my grandma is so close to me. It's such a personal memory. I love that memory. It's more that there's so much that's outside of that imagination. If you sit back and let your imagination or memory of you pulling your grandma's, you start realizing like, oh shit, there's so much for that moment to come to be. And I think that's why weight is so easily found in imagination of time, because you can never imagine time with everything.
Are you talking about the scope of history, Walt? Are you talking about the scope and weight of history?
The scope and weight of history, but even the future. If you're imagining like global warming, you can imagine like the melting snow caps, and you're like, wow, the melting snow caps are so fucking scary. And then you sit with it and it's like, oh, wait, it's not just the melting snow caps. It's my annoyance of fucking how people who want to fucking say environmentalism is bad. And like, there's just so much outside of that imagination that can crush into that imagination. And that's what I mean by like why I think it's so hard to imagine time without weight. Yeah, so in Devita is a fable. It's linked to the past. If we're talking about symbolism, the ghost comes from a banyan tree, and trees are like the biggest symbolisms of like weighted history, right? We always imagine trees with 200 years.
Well, I mean, just think about the Giving Tree, right? The Giving mm-hmm. Tree by Shel Silverstein, right? It's literally a man's life, a boy to a man's life, told through the growth of one tree, right? Like there's nothing more symbolic in that moment than just like, this tree is a life. It is history.
Yeah, trees, man. I hate nature, but a singular tree?
Just one tree.
That's kind of sexy.
Just one tree. One bee, just one tree, one flea, OG.
Last week, even, like, we were talking about how I said the characters were complicated, and then we went into, like, patriarchy and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then the Western gaze and all that stuff. Very good conversation. I don't mean to shit talk it. But I think my brain was so messed up that I, like, completely delivered that wrong, completely fucked it up and didn't have a good conversation with you. You are right. The patriarchy is a big deal. You weren't just a fucking baby white person who had their Western gaze in that movie. What it was, though, is that you said that the apathy in that movie was really interesting.
Yes.
And I said, I think that apathy is what makes her really complicated. And you disagreed.
I don't think it was a complicated complication.
Da, 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 it's so complicated. Nice like this.
Everything's just going to get complicated.
I, first of all, find the apathy kind of, and I know you and Pretty don't always get along together. So maybe why.
It depends what the Pretty's juxtaposed with. My problem with Devita was that there was a lot of Pretty and not a lot of gross. Fooly Cooley does that a little bit, juxtaposes like the kind of gross or intense or unpleasant with stuff that's like really like the apathy that the female lead in Devita has is not unlike the apathy that Mamimi sometimes has with the boy's name. He'll come up on Mamimi and she's just like sitting there smoking. Like there's a lot of apathy in that. Like she's just like kind of like letting the wind blow her. And that's like similar. So I get why you think the apathy is pretty. I would agree that I think there is some beauty in the apathy presented in Devita.
Well, it's also that I do think the apathy is at least a little related to that sort of weight.
Apathy's tied to history, right? That's kind of what, like, the apathy is not just I'm feeling apathetic because I'm lazy or I'm tired or I'm sad. The apathy is in direct conversation with everything that's happening to this woman. The fact that she has no control is where the apathy manifests. And the reason she has no control is because of her understanding of her own history, both as a person and as a woman.
Sometimes I think what it is, too, is that I mix up pretty and beauty with weight. I think sometimes I, like, finish something and I feel the weight of it, and I think to myself, wow, that was so beautiful. But what I really felt was this, like, over-commencement of weight. And you know what? I think Kant would call it the sublime. So
Yeah, the sublime. I mean, and probably Nietzsche would probably connect it to anxiety, right? Like, there's like a combination of between the two of those.
Yeah, probably. Though it would be kind of weird to be like, wow, I just came out of a movie feeling this incredible anxiety.
Well, but you've never experienced that where you've like seen something so earth-shaking, so sublime that it like gives you a level of anxiety?
I do, but usually I think the overwhelming bliss of that sublimity overcomes that.
The anxiety, yeah.
In the end, everything I said here is not that special. Anyone can do this. All films can feel it. You can talk about films in this way all the time. I think there's something intentional in Devita that I feel, and I think in the combination of my obsession with the details, the colors, the pretty woman, it helps me enjoy this experimentation of time even more clearly than if I sit in a lot of other movies.
We talked a lot about either or both. Both is what we talked about. I think it's interesting because I actually want to talk about the use of both in horror, focusing on Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, starring Joan Crawford and Bette Midler.
What? Is that her name? Bette and Whittler? What the fuck? I never pronounced
Bette
it as
Bette Midler
that.
And Joan Crawford. How would you have said? How would you have said it, Walt?
Betty Davis.
Okay, that is a different person. That's a different person.
Who's Bette Midler? Who
Bette
the fuck
Midler
is
Baby Jane? Bette Midler is Baby Jane.
Who the fuck is Bette Midler? I don't even know if that's a name that's English.
Oh, you're right. It is Betty Davis. Oh fuck! I'm such an idiot. Oh god, who's Bette Midler? Oh man, I feel like such an asshole. I am talking about Bette Midler, who was in Hocus Pocus, The First Wives Club, Beaches. Oh, you idiot. That's it. Kick me off the podcast. She was in Stepford Wives. She was in The Old Feeling. Oh, kick me off the podcast. She was on the Bette Midler Show.
I still don't know who the fuck this person is.
So, it stars Joan Crawford and Betty Davis. And I'm ruthless. So, I went into this movie kind of not with a whole lot of excitement. Because it's old. to be frank, I was like, my dad was talking about it, and that was why I thought about watching it. And it actually kind of blew me out of the water. There are two girls who are sisters, Baby Jane and Blanche. And Baby Jane is a famous child star who like is kind of like Shirley Temple. And she's like a spoiled brat. And Blanche gets ignored and mistreated. And then as adults, Blanche is a famous actress. And Baby Jane can't get any good roles and is a bad actress.
Because she's an alcoholic.
And then Blanche gets hit by a car that Baby Jane was driving and becomes wheelchair bound. And so basically Baby Jane just takes care of Blanche. And Blanche is like very kind to her. And Baby Jane is very mean and abuses her and is drunk. As she gets more and more unhinged because she's realizing that Blanche wants to sell the house they live in together and move away and put her somewhere to be safe. Baby Jane does more and more bad things. She takes Blanche's pet bird and serves it to her for dinner. And then Blanche is like terrified to eat. And so Baby Jane shows her like the next meal that she gives her. And it's like a totally fine meal. But she takes it away because she's like, you didn't want to eat it. So now you don't get to eat it. And then the next time she brings her a meal and Blanche is starving, she goes and it's just a giant dead rat in the center of her plate. And she hits her and she belittles her. She slowly begins taking away her abilities to communicate with the outside world. She takes away her phone. She takes away her ability to call for Baby Jane.
Wait, just for the Zoomers, it's not a mobile phone.
No, this is a rotary phone. And actually, one of the interesting things is one of the ways she keeps in the beginning of the movie, one of the ways Baby Jane keeps Blanche from using the phone is she takes the phone off the hook. The phone line is busy. So Blanche can't make any calls. And so one of the really intense things is that because Blanche is wheelchair bound, she's at her mercy completely. Like normally these women would be at similar powers. They would have like similar physical strength. Blanche is taller and she doesn't drink as much so she'd probably be more skilled at dealing with Baby Jane if it comes to that, which it did come to. But because she is wheelchair bound, she has no ability. She's paralyzed from the waist down. So you get something that's like very anxiety producing. It's like a common horror trope. You see it in Misery is a big one. Misery, written by Stephen King. A similar lack of someone being empowered or disempowered shows up in Baby Jane. I actually feel like some of the scenes in these kidnapping movies or these rape revenge movies where the female character is like about to get away, but they have to do something really intense and really dangerous is very similar to the scene where Blanche is trying to get down the stairs. And so she's like just pulling herself along down the stairs out of her wheelchair. And she eventually falls down the stairs to get there, but she retrieves the phone. And it's such a tense scene. It's so fucking tense. Do you know the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course, of course. One of the things I noticed about this dynamic is that this could have all been solved if she lived on the first floor.
That's true. That is 100% true. If Blanche lived on the first floor, things would have been a lot easier.
Exactly. And it goes to show, like, we were talking about staircases in Duvida. Completely different understanding of what a staircase is to this film. And that's really fascinating, honestly, because staircases are such mundane things, but they can fucking do so much for a narrative.
No, in both Misery and What Happened to Baby Jane, the stairs are an antagonist. The stairs are insurmountable, right? Like, it is so difficult for both of these people to get past the stairs.
And the other thing about that, too, is usually the insurmountable in our understanding of our brains is the uphill.
Yes.
For these, it's the down.
It's literally the down is the problem. Mm-hmm. And it's because you could fall down. You can't, it's hard to fall up.
It reminds me of some of those cycling mangas that we used to read.
Oh, Yaoimusha Pedal?
Yeah.
Uphill, yeah, Yaoimusha Pedal, bro.
The uphill specialist would always be like cool, but then the downhill specialist, that was the fucking rad dude that you...
No, dude, loved. I like the uphill guys the best. They were my favorite. The guy who's really? Like, Hime, Hime, I love you, Princess Hime. And he's like going up, like without a care in the world. Dude, he's so great. Don't watch Baby Jane. Don't watch Dravida. Just watch Yaoimusha Pedal. Just like watch that because it's so... I read it, actually. I've not watched it, but read it. It's so fucking good. It'll make you actually care about bicycles.
Dude, I don't know. I think these type of mangas set up the downhill specialist to be unique because you always have to face the uphill specialist first before you can reveal the downhill specialist
character. Yeah, the downhill specialist. That's true. Yeah,
so it's like, wow, these guys are so good at uphill. Why is this guy the better racer? And then they get to the top of the mountain, the climax. Just this huge, nice manga panel of the downhill specialist zipping down and fucking beating all those people who did all the hard work to get
up. Not to get too far from the point, but the downhill villains are usually way weirder than the uphill peddlers. Because the uphill guys who are the villains are usually just like hardworking and it's like, oh man, like we're trying so hard, who can triumph? And the downhill guys are like, I look like a bug!
Yeah, you know, like, super they're the weird. Crazy one. Exactly.
Yeah, they're the crazy ones.
And that's why this film, the downhill was, as you said, anxiety, but they also had to put in a lot of work to do that downhill. So it's almost like a reversal of the role in a way.
But so I think we talked about being both a little bit in the podcast before, and I think I've been thinking a lot about binaries. And because if it was just like a sister abusing her wheelchair-bound sister, it would not be a horror movie. But Bette Davis is like so creepy. And it took me a while to figure out exactly what it is. And some of it is aesthetics. Her face is very white, like very whitely makeup to like in comparison to the other characters who look like they have normal faces. She's like almost like been painted bright white. And she has these big, they're black because it's a black and white film, but these big, I'm assuming they're red, big red lips. Well, so she looks like the Joker is my first thing I thought of because of my Batman fetish.
Harley Quinn.
No, she does not look like Harley Quinn. That is a bad one. You've made an incorrect connection. No, she really does. She has this wild sneer. And she's always smiling. And it also, I think, more than reminding me of the Joker, it reminds me of one of the early films that inspired the Joker's character design, The Man Who Laughs, which is based on a Victor Hugo novel, I think. And the character just is, like, forced, like, because of some king or something, I can't quite remember why, forced to have this, like, horrible Joker-style grin. And when they were coming up with the character design for the Joker, they went to that film. There's this, like, horrible smile that Bette Davis, aka Baby Jane, has. But again, if that was just it wouldn't be horrible. What I think the horror manifests is that there's this really ugly push and pull between age and elderliness versus youthfulness and babiness. Baby Davis, when she's not like being mean to her sister in like a very old lady mean voice, she's like downstairs playing the piano and singing this creepy little song about I want to write a letter to daddy who is now in heaven. And so instead of writing it as a letter, I'm going to mail it with a kiss. And she's just like slinking around in this like little girl voice. I want to write a letter to daddy and seal it with a kiss.
But her elderly voice cracks into it too.
Yes, exactly. She fails. Good horror is pulling at something that's real, right?
Here's another word that Swede loves using, real.
Okay. There is something, okay, all right, how about No, fine, fuck you, Walt. How about this? Archetypal. There's something archetypal inside the fear that makes it good. So when we talk about The Shining, the archetypal feel there is the death of a child, the betrayal of a parent, the loss of self-control, the fear of isolation, right? Things that outside of ghosts and goblins are terrifying to deal with in reality. And I think the archetypal fears that you see in Bette Davis's portrayal of Baby Jane is the inability to grow up while being juxtaposed with the ugliness of age. She exists on both sides of the binary, but fails in both accounts. She's not a good old person because she's mean and hateful, and she's not a good youth because she's old, right? And so we're faced with this like thing that exists on both sides of the binary in a really chilling way. I think sometimes horror movies will do this in a way that's less cool. A good example is having like really androgynous characters and they're supposed to be scary, and part of that fear is that they exist on both sides of the binary. They feel like both man and woman. That's like kind of a shitty trope that you see in characters. That's like a less fun way to deal with being on both sides of the binary. On the other hand, if you look at, oh god, any movie with a scary child, right? The double side of the binary is the innocence of a child versus the horror and the terror and the violence of an evil, right? And so I think that this like really kind of terrifying manifestation of like old and young at the same time is really uncomfortable. And I think it comes from a real place. I don't know if you have issues with this, but I don't like old folks homes. And one of the things that makes me the most uncomfortable is when you're interacting with someone who is old and because of dementia and stuff like that has returned to that of a child. It always gives me the willies, which is not to say that it's bad that they're there, right? Like, that's just sometimes what happens to people. But it does freak me out a good bit, and part of it's because I don't want to be there. I mean, we all progress so much as we live, right? Like, we become more wise, we become more powerful, right? Like, we feel like we're more in control of our existences as we get older. And then to have that, like, slowly taken away from you is horrifying to me, right? Do you get what I'm saying?
I've heard a lot of people have this understanding of old folks home. I don't know. For me personally, I can recognize the fear about it, so I'm not in disagreement with it. It's just something I try really hard to not embrace. Normally, our narratives of old people are not great in general.
That's totally
true.
So
I'm very careful of letting age or oldness become a symbolism of death. And I understand why it exists. It's just something I don't like to really let manifest.
See, and I hate all old people with a deep, burning passion. That's actually not true. When I worked at the movie theater, I hated old people.
But those old people weren't the people with dementia coming into your store reminding you that they were about to die, right?
That's true. And those people don't come into the bookstore either. I don't know, Walt, did you find Bette Davis's portrayal of Baby Jane scary?
I recognize it's a horror film.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say like I felt that type of anxiety or fear in a very visceral or emotional way.
So I will say, I don't think this movie's going to keep me up at night. Very rarely do movies keep me up at night, and when they do, it's usually something I did not enjoy. But I did think she was creepy, right? Like, it was like very weird imagining this woman in the real world, like you're walking and just like old ladies singing this like little kid song at home drunk, and you know upstairs is her sister who's like not being fed. It's like super, super, super gross and super weird. And there's also like this like undercurrent of like her obsession with her dad that's really weird. It doesn't ever get commented on. Like, there's never any reference to something fucked up her dad did. It's just like weird.
You know, I think what it is too is that there's so many symbols and parallels in this film that it's hard for me to really experience the anxiety, weirdness, and fear as an emotional experience because I'm overloaded by parallels, messages, and all this stuff.
And I think I want to get to the spoiler of the big twist of what happened to Baby Jane, which is that, as it turns out, Baby Jane did not hit Blanche with her car to cause her to be paralyzed. Instead, Blanche tried to hit Baby Jane with her car, and in the process of trying to run her sister down, became paralyzed. And Baby Jane was so drunk that Blanche just went along with the other narrative, which was that her sister tried to hit her. And so this whole time, Baby Jane was like yoked to her sister, and there's all this like guilt and anger and frustration. It was really all done by Blanche. You know, she was the one who lied to her sister, and she's the one who, there's actually a line, it's chilling. Bette Davis, Baby Jane, eventually has a complete break from reality after killing a person, and is just like in la-la little girl land, and it's just like, the police are gonna get me in trouble, they're mad at me, oh no, what do I do? And she takes her sister, who hasn't been fed in a few days, and is like getting ready to die, to the beach, and is just like playing in the sand, like la-la-la, la-la-la. Blanche is like, I'm dying, I need to tell you. Bette Davis, who's now completely regressed to a child, is like, what do you mean? And Blanche is crying, and she's like, you weren't ugly like this, I made you this way, I made you this ugly. The really chilling bit at the end is Bette Davis goes and she says, I'm gonna go get us ice cream, and she goes and she takes two ice cream cones from a like ice cream shop and then just walks away without paying, and the guys are like, hey, you need to pay for that. And the cops, who are out looking for Blanche and Baby Jane because the police have found out she's been kidnapped, go after her, and they find her, and they're talking to her and like, where's your sister, where's your sister? And people are gathering around her, and being like, oh my God, look at this weirdo lady. Is that that old woman who used to be Baby Jane? Oh my God, oh my God. And then it cuts to Bette Davis's point of view. And it's like this weird half audio where you can't really hear what they're saying. And she's just like looking and everyone's looking at her and she's the center of attention again. And with the ice cream cones in her hand, she just starts twirling around and dancing and walking as the crowd follows her. And then it slowly pans out. Ugh, that did give me chills. That, like, ugh, so fucking weird, so fucking uncomfortable. And I think that archetypal fear we're getting at is, like, a complete break from reality, which is terrifying to me. Breaking from reality is one of those things I never want to have to experience again.
So, honestly, you know another reason why I might not have felt that scaredness so much is because just 12 years earlier, two films came out sort of about this sort of age of actresses with youth, All About Eve and Sunset Boulevard. Sunset Boulevard and All About Eve get compared all the time because they came out the same year. And I don't think it's an accident that Bette Davis is in one of them, who also still plays the aging actress.
Okay.
If we're talking about that last scene that showed you, it's a fucking fantastic scene of her holding two ice creams on a beach. But Sunset Boulevard, basically, she also gets in trouble with killing someone. And when the police come in, she descends downstairs in all her caked up makeup as like a young celebrity and thinks she's like in paparazzi.
Like a star. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of like murder procedurals that follow this narrative. There's actually one in Criminal Minds that I think is like directly referencing what happened to Baby Jane. I think Criminal Minds is maybe morally reprehensible. I think it like pornographies violence in a way that is kind of uncool morally, but I watch it. I like it. I just like, I feel guilty watching it. But there is an episode that's like very weird and very creepy where this guy's like dead mother. He's like psychologically created this like dead mom and he keeps her course. And at the end, he's like walking out to paparazzi, but it's really the police who are surrounding him and he's like holding his mother's hand. Only in real life, he's carrying his mother's desiccated corpse. So those two things you're talking about are like built into the foundation of this kind of horror narrative, right? Which is a break from reality. And I think it gives the same kind of chill that the end of The Shining does. I know I reference that a lot, but it's really, it was influential. Both the film and the book were influential on me as a child. The last scene in the movie, though, where it slowly fades away and you realize that Jack's been at the hotel the whole time. And he hasn't really, but that like his picture is like in there, right? Like he's been swallowed up by the hotel. A similar chill, a similar like really uncomfortable sort of just like bad end, right? Like you ever like playing like the visual novels, the porn games you love so much where it's like the bad end.
The bad end.
That's what these movies are. These are the bad end. Compare it to like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is an awesome movie. Super fun, super, super gross. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre's end isn't like a gong. I don't know how much you want me to talk about short writing. A good short story should leave you with kind of like an emotional echo. Like if someone hit like a gong inside your chest and it just like echoes in your body. And you know, like Flannery O'Connor does that in almost every one of her short stories. She just like ends on something and you're like, oh man, holy shit. I think the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a fun movie, but it doesn't do this.
What I found interesting about what you were talking about is that you compared a lot of it to sort of books, short stories, because I do think what you're talking about sort of disappears along Hollywood. Somewhere in the lines after New Hollywood really becomes like the main force of what Hollywood wants to put out, a lot of films start getting less melodramatic, less gongy, and more like subtle or realistic. Or I don't know what the word is. Watching this was like so resonating to me that like I was like, fuck, I forgot there was these type of movies that felt so intentional in their metaphors and that the plot was so directed. There was always a climax to be had or something like that, right?
And I will say that I think old Hollywood is more stylistically connected to novels and short stories, right? Like as we get further in the tradition of films, people experiment more and more and show how it's less of a book and more of its own thing, right? But I mean, like Baby Jane, whatever happened to Baby Jane is based off a novel.
Because it is very specific to Hollywood because, you know, other countries, they didn't have as much money.
Well, and this is still a time when you know, like nowadays, like when people think about like, oh, the movies are coming out, it tends to be actors, directors, or occasionally franchises, right? So it's either like the famous director, the famous actor, or it's Marvel, or it's Disney, or it's DC or whatever. But, you know, back during the Hollywood era, it was publishing companies, right? It was like, it was actual houses. And so for actors and actresses, right, you would kind of become like linked in with these publishing houses. And if you started doing poorly, that was on you, right? In a very different way than it is now, right? Because you can do poorly in a movie now as an actor, and it's like, well, it's a fine. It's because you're not the main focus, right? Not only does it make the story of Baby Jane feel more relevant because of how much of a rejection it would be for Baby Jane to lose her place, but it's also so connected to the actual act of the filmmaking, right? I think maybe there's like something there, like horror novels about writing and horror movies about movies to me always feel a little bit scarier than normal because there's so much honesty in both of them, right?
I think it's interesting what you said because Sunset Boulevard and All About Eve came out in 1950. There was a trend in that type of Hollywood that liked talking about aging actresses. I think the movies of aging actresses still exist, but definitely not blockbusters in the same way those three films are that have such a fucking legendary status to them. You're right, because studios lost its power, so this type of story is almost not even as relevant to today.
When, and also, aging actors and actresses in this day and age gain cult status, right? Like, you know, people don't care how old Elvira, the Mistress of Darkness, is. They just want to, like, go see her, even if she's, like, ancient, right?
Some of them do drop off and disappear, though.
That's true. Some of them do drop off. But, like, for instance, Betty White.
A lot.
Yeah, a lot. Okay, but okay. You're right. I'm worthless. Cancel me. I don't know the difference.
Maybe that's actually fair. It's like, we don't subjugate their dropping off with age. We pretend it's something else.
We pretend it's something to do with skill or activity or something like that, when it's probably age, and it's probably because they don't look as nice. But also, if you think about the age, right, like, it doesn't have enough time. There's not enough time for these actors and actresses to gain cult status because the movies have only been around for so long, right? Or do you think that's a load of horse shit?
No, I think that's true. So Charlie Chaplin also made a movie around that time called Limelight. So that was also about his personal sort of aging. He says it's not about him. He says this movie, Limelight, is about this character who used to play blackface all the time in the past.
Okay. Charlie Chaplin never did blackface, just saying.
But he loved an actor who did blackface if he wanted to credit it. Limelight all to that.
I didn't know he
film.
Loved him. God damn it, Charlie Chaplin, my boy.
I don't know.
Where did you
I don't
go?
Know if he loved him. I don't know if he loved him. No, but that's why I think the 40s, 50s, and 60s had such a boost of those movies, because you're right, those movies came out at a time that they didn't get to see their 20, 30, 40 actresses get to the old age. Because first of all, you were probably dying.
Yeah.
Or you were too young.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
When you couldn't hold movies in the same way that you can now, right? It doesn't matter. I'm going to talk about Elvira, Mistress of Darkness again, because she was like another piece of media that informed my childhood growing up. It doesn't matter how old she ever gets, because I have the VHS tape of The Hideous Sun Demon, and I can pop it into my ancient VHS player and watch it and be like, oh man, I remember when I was 12 and I didn't know what a titty felt like, and I was like, damn, Elvira's cute and young, and I don't know how to feel about any of this because I'm like confused about all of this.
Dude, that's actually so fucking interesting. I didn't even think about this. That's the difference between Baby Jane and Sunset Boulevard and All About Eve 2. That movie came out 12 years later when movies were getting onto television. So it created a whole new like desire to revisit the concept of the aging actress because of that.
That's true, because part of the reason Baby Jane gets so jealous is that Blanche's movies are being shown on TV again.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what causes a lot of the stress.
And maybe that's why that film was sort of one of the last ones, because the television kept a lot of people's lives continuing. So wait, do we have any new emails or reveals to shout out?
Not this episode. So if you are interested in getting a shout out on our episode, feel free to email us, fakefilmfans@gmail.com, or just leave us a review on iTunes.
Honestly, though, I'm really disappointed in all of you listeners. Like,
no,
you guys are
don't
making
say
me...
that. We love you. We love you.
You guys
all.
Are close to making me write emails to the fucking Gmail and just pretend there's someone else. Like, that's how sad you're making me.
I swear on my heart, I will never let that happen, especially because I know Walter. I know every word will be misspelled if Walter sends it.
Now, instead of drunk calling people, I may just drunk email this podcast.
Yeah, you'll just drunk email. I just love this podcast so much.
I'm actually really sad because I'm having a crush and they don't crush back.
But this podcast makes me crush less. And I just love Anna Karina.
That's true. That's true. Do you think there's a way to make words sound like they're crying? You're the writer here, dude.
Yeah, I mean, do you want a serious answer?
What, an emoji?
An emoji. Yeah, actually, my novel I'm working on right now is 100% written in emojis. And whenever I have characters who are upset, it's just the crying emoji.
Dude, one day, though, you're going to pick up a novel and it's going to be like celebrated by New York Times. And it's because they understood how to use emojis differently than everyone else.
Dude, those already exist. There's this collection of like juvenile fiction novels that are all Shakespeare, only they're written through texts. So like Romeo and Juliet are like, OMG, bae, I love you. I wish your dad wasn't such a jerk. Heart emoji. They're terrible. They're like, I'm not so...
But they're juvenile books.
I'm not someone who like cares about the purity of a text, right? Like, go ahead and make like Frankenstein, only this time he has like a samurai sword or like whatever. Like, mess with whatever you want. I don't care about that. But they are just like so... You can tell whoever wrote this was like an English teacher who's like 45 and she's like drinking her glass of wine and she's like, I'm going to make this for the kids. It's going to be so fun. Oh my God. And like, it's just like so tone deaf, so jaded. You know who likes those books are the people who become that woman. The book this is written for is for the 40-year-old teacher when she was a little girl.
Did you ever read Unfortunate Series?
The series of unfortunate events? I did.
I know he doesn't do experimental writing. But as a kid, it's like, oh my God, look, there's two pages, just one word. That's so cool.
No, exactly. And like him interacting with the audience and him like telling the reader, like, I'm not going to tell you this. It's totally genius. I think it's miles above a lot of stuff, even in like the YA section.
But in retrospect, it only works in the YA, right? It had to be a YA book for that type of writing to work, you think? Or no?
No. I think this is, there's like a pretty lengthy tradition. And those aren't YA novels. Those are juvenile fiction novels.
Okay, I don't know the difference.
YA is Twilight. YA is Twilight and 13 Reasons Why. Juvenile fiction is like for a younger audience. I think those books are actually smarter than a lot of other books. I think the series of unfortunate events is way smarter than The Hunger Games. I think it's way smarter.
Dude,
than...
I'm not gonna lie. I thought juvenile meant prison for some reason. You know why? Because I keep hearing juvenile prison. So I thought you were talking about prison. I thought you were shit talking these prisoners who were writing books and text with emojis, and you're being like, they were 45 old wine ladies.
No, juvenile fiction. It's okay. All right, let me break this down. It goes picture books, early reader books, which are books that have just a few words like Dick and Jane, middle reader novels, and juvenile fiction, which are kind of like similar. So like A Bridge to Terabithia, books that you're going to read from like age like 6 to age like 12.
Wait, Bridge to Terabithia is before juvenile?
No, Bridge to Terabithia is juvenile fiction. And then you get to YA.
Yeah, dude, now you mention it like that, juvenile books are so much darker. Bridge to Terabithia fucking tore the fuck me up. Wait, man.
I think it's because the juvenile fiction novels have to be written for a younger audience to understand, so that you don't have to deal with the angst in the same way. When I was the target audience, I was reading it, and I very quickly realized, and if you love YA and you're listening to this podcast, no tea, no shade, it's all good, we're all allowed to like what we like, but YA is written for this like really specific audience that's just like taking itself so seriously and also stylistically taking itself so seriously. Where you get to juvenile fiction, and because of the amount of words and the lexicon you can use to describe what's going on to that audience, it's so much more limited. So I think it's more emotionally effective.
Still, you killed someone. You killed the best fucking friend in, like, is that normal to give your 13-year-old person a read?
I think you'd give it to him earlier than 13. I'd give it to him when they're 10, 8 or 9, 9 or 10. I mean, Old Yeller is similar.
That's true, dude. Those dog books, Where the Red Fern Grows was like my favorite book for the longest of fucking time. Oh my God. When that red fern grows at that fucking end. When those two red ferns grows.
That's that gong we were talking about. That is the gong.
You're right. I guess that stuff isn't YA.
It's because YA, I think YA, you reach a point where it's consumptive and it's a series and it's an adventure. When you finish Hunger Games, you're like, yeah, I know there's going to be a fucking sequel. It's not self-contained in the same way. I don't know. I'm being an asshole. There are a lot of people who really love YA and I just don't get it. And I think that's maybe my failing. If you like YA, shoot us an email. Send us a tweet. Tell us about what's good YA and I'll check it out. I'll read it. I have access to infinite amount of books.
Oh, all right. That sounds interesting. You know what I'll read?
What?
Your emails.
Send us some emails. Give us a tweet.
Send us some fucking emails.
Send us some emails. Give us a 5-star rating. It's still the 55-star slapathon. Come on.
Slapathon, babies. Let's get the slapathon up, up, up. We got to watch Sweet get slapped. This isn't something we've said before, but, you know, another way to help us out is to share the podcast with anyone you think that likes films, media.
Yeah, that's really what you should be doing, because we're so lonely, and, like, Walter gets to live in his opulent tower in Hong Kong, but I'm, like, out here living in my parents' upstairs, and it sucks, and it's hot, and I would like to live anywhere but here, so please just help us out. Help me out.
Yeah, we're down to talk about films or books, Swain, or, hey, Salih, do you have anything to add? I'm joking.
Yeah, I love movies. I'm still totally here. I didn't leave at all to eat my Chipotle or whatever because I'm a bad podcast host. Give us 5 stars and we'll fucking make Celine eat a turtle. I'll make Celine eat a live turtle for 5 stars. Well, everyone, thanks for joining us and thanks for indulging in our whining and begging for fame. I think the only thing left to say is if you're going to watch a movie, do it with the lights off.